From WAMU at 88.5, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome. I knew you were waiting for me to say welcome.
Don't screw up the schedule of the show.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Wes Moore, the projected winner of the Democratic primary for Maryland governor. He's also a best-selling author and former nonprofit CEO. Joining us in studio now is Randy Clark. He is the new WMATA general manager. That's the general manager of Metro. Randy Clark, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, appreciate being here, Kojo and Tom. Listened to your show before when I lived here, and really happy to be joining you today.
Before we get to Metro, Tom Sherwood, the D.C. mayor, who has been coming under some criticism for not extending city services to immigrants who have been bused here from two southern states, Texas and Arizona, has decided that she would like the National Guard to help with the migrants because she sees it still as a federal issue.
Well, she also sees it as a humanitarian effort. She's not looking for the National Guard to guard these folks. She's looking for help in getting them to a safe place. You know, the governors of Arizona and Texas have been sending migrants to Washington and other jurisdictions.
More than 5,000 so far.
Yes. And the problem for the mayor, she says, is that many of the people, these people who are coming, are not undocumented people who have come to the country illegally. They've gone through the process. They have a place to go in this country. But the governors of those two states are sending them out of their area up to other places. So the mayor wants to give them a safe place to rest, to get sanitation, food, and then send them on their way to wherever they're going. An official told me this morning, many of the ones who've come already are from Venezuela, and they were going to Miami and other different places. So the mayor says the city's being overwhelmed. She's not trying to throw them out. She's trying to help them, but she needs National Guard help to transport them, to get them to a new center that they will open somewhere sometime.
And this next one may be of some interest to our guests because it has to do with traffic safety in the District of Columbia. A lot of people are objecting to the fact that people are still dying on the streets despite the mayor's Vision Zero program, which is supposed to present us with zero traffic deaths. What's going on?
Well, Vision Zero has been a zero pretty much overall, both here and in other jurisdictions. But too many people have been, pedestrians or cyclists have been killed. I think the number's 11 now. And the advocates who had a protest down on Pennsylvania Avenue at the Wilson Building this week want the mayor to be more aggressive in getting the Department of Transportation to do more infrastructure changes to the streets to make them safer, to enforce the traffic rules to make them more safe. And they have protested there. And the mayor had a birthday party last night in Southwest.
Were you invited?
I knew about it.
You gatecrashed.
There's a difference between being invited and knowing about it.
Okay.
And had a big crowd there. And some of the protesters showed up there also. It was a small group protesting that the mayor needs to do something more quickly to make the streets safer.
Again, our guest is Randy Clark, the new WMATA general manager, the Metro general manager. We're glad you were able to get here on Metro, Randy Clark, but we wanted to make sure you got here, so we sent our transportation reporter, Jordan Pascal, to make sure you got here on time. Did you?
Yes, he was a great escort, so appreciate Jordan helping me with my wayfinding.
He was also hanging around when you spent your first day on the job talking with Metro riders at L'Enfant Plaza. He was there, and it sounded like you got an earful. Here's one interaction.
I assume you're looking to have more of these really new trains back and a lot more frequency?
Yeah, well, there are kind of just only a couple of them out, because that's the big problem.
Anyway, we're going to work hard trying to get you a lot more service back, so this is only day one for me, so we're working on it.
This particular person seemed to echo something we've heard a lot. Train frequency is a problem. Was that the biggest concern you heard?
I would say overall, I mean, I heard a fair amount from a variety of customers. You know, our customer base is not monolithic, so there's going to be different concerns. And someone that I've heard from some bus customers that are actually very happy with their bus routes, and other ones that there's issues. But I would say, you know, on the rail side specifically, frequency of service is probably the concern I've heard the most about. And I am happy that we were able to announce at yesterday's board meeting a frequency increase on the Blue, Orange, and Silver lines. We're going now from 20-minute frequency to 15 minutes. So certainly not to where we want to be and what the region is used to and what it deserves. But hopefully people see that we're going at least in the right direction, moving towards more frequency.
Tom Sherwood was at L'Enfant Plaza also.
Yes, I was there. I watched you interacting with the folks there. Basically, it appeared to be a good experience for you. I did take a picture of you walking up an escalator that wasn't working, so maybe I'll get to that in a moment. But, you know, the arbiter of taste, Twitter, has been quite critical about whether or not you can speed up the service with the problems with the 7,000 series cars. And you also said this week that you're confident, I think you said it this week, that you're confident that the Silver Line will be opening with service maybe by October. Is that correct? Will the Silver Line going out to Dulles be working?
We should nuance the language. So the exact language I said is the staff will have all of our work done to what will happen is...
This is the Silver Line.
Yes, on the Silver Line. Our operations and capital team, working with our partners at MWA, who obviously have the punch
MWA?
List. Yeah, the airport authority.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's building that part of the line. There's some punch list items. We're actually in the process now with an employee pick to get assignments, then there'll be training, simulate service, emergency drills. We believe we'll have all of that work done in October. What happens then is our safety officer will do a safety certification. Then that goes to the Metro Safety Commission and the Federal Transit Administration for their concurrence. So our work, we believe, will be done in October, but we're going to be working in parallel with our partners, but they do have to do their final piece. So
short answer is this holiday season, I'm not taking a train to Dulles.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, Tom. I think that's being overly cynical on that. I think, you know, we're working really closely with our partners. I just want to be clear that it's not just Metro's piece.
It's not your decision.
There's multiple boxes that have to be checked off. But we are clearly making progress. So I think we're getting closer and closer. And hopefully by the September board meeting, we can get to a more refined date.
Frankly, Tom Sherwood, I'm surprised that you did not dig up any really remote facts about Randy Clark to share with us today.
I looked. He was so bland. He's, you know, from Austin. You know, it's just...
Well,
he doesn't play in a... As far as I know, he doesn't play in a band. He doesn't ride a unicycle or anything.
Bicycles. Bicycles.
Well, we have
I'm a two-wheel guy.
We have a caller, James in Dumfries, Virginia, who apparently would like to know more. James, you're on the air. Go ahead, please. Hi, James. Are you there? Well, it is my understanding that James's question had to do with what you stand for. I don't know whether James wants to talk politics, because this is the politics hour.
Yes, we do want to talk
James
politics.
James is not there right now.
And so. I will not be engaging.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm hearing James in the background. Hello?
Hi. I'm just curious. I don't know anything about this. I just wanted to know more about you.
Is there anything more you have
Give
to
us what I do
James?
To the interns. Give us your 30-second bio.
Oh, well, just about me on a more personal level, I guess. So, well, I have a wife, a couple dogs. We're both pretty active cyclists and runners, so we'll be around doing a lot of that. Happen to be a vegetarian. Met my wife on the subway in Boston. And I don't
That's
know.
It, James. That's
and
enough.
You came
favorite
from,
favorite
you
color from, blue.
And
I
you
don't
came
know.
From Austin. Where did you go to school in this region, or where did you go to school?
No, I actually grew up in Nova Scotia, Canada, and then I did grad school in the Northeast, spent a lot of my kind of adult life, I guess, living in Boston area, and then here for a couple of years, then I was down in Austin for four as a CEO down there, and I've had now the opportunity to be back here.
You'll have to go on a bike ride around here with Pete Buttigieg, the DDOT director.
Secretary of
Transportation.
I'd love to get out with the secretary.
He bikes all the time.
Yeah, that's exactly.
James, thank you for your call. There are delays and track work on so many lines. We have a standing weekly story on DCS.com to cover those disruptions. 15 minutes wait times between trains is not uncommon. How do you plan to bring riders back when people can't count on timely service?
Yeah, no, there's no question, Kojo. That is mission one, right? We have to get the customers back on the service, and they're not coming back until we provide a really good quality service that's reliable. So as I mentioned at the board meeting yesterday, we announced better frequency on Blue, Orange, and Silver, and that's really important for overwhelming amount of the network. So a lot of the stations have multiple lines, so it's actually more frequent than 15 minutes. And if you make a transfer in the system, that's actually better as well. But, you know, we also have our major capital program, whether it's a good example is the Orange Line shutdown with the platforms kind of in the eastern part of the Orange Line. That work will be completed just after Labor Day. But that work is crucial. I mean, it's work that kind of was deferred repair for 25 plus years. And so for us to run a good, reliable, safe system long term, that work had to be done. And WMATA has done an enormous amount of work over the last 5-6 years on that. And I want to make sure, you know, credit is given to the staff and, you know, the former GM and the board for that. They put a lot of funding into making the system better. And I think as we get through a few more of these projects, the community is going to see an overall better, more reliable product.
On the big scale, you just mentioned part of it. The basic mantra for a public transportation is it needs to be safe, affordable, reliable, and convenient. Where on the big picture scale is Metro Rail and that system and Metro Bus separately? Are you 70%, 80% there? Is it possible to say?
I guess I maybe a little more clarity on that, Tom, because, I mean, all those things, I'm with you. The service has to be safe, frequent, reliable, and affordable. So, I mean, I think we are, I fundamentally believe we are a safe system. Good. But we'll never be to a point where safety isn't part of our culture and everything that we do, right? And that's, you know, whether you're at the police department, the fire department, us, et cetera, will never be enough. And we're going to keep working. That has to be cultural DNA. Frequency, clearly not enough. Now, if you ask some people on the bus side, we actually increased frequency before I got here on certain bus lines that's actually more service than before COVID. But there's other places that we're dropping some trips and the service isn't good enough. You know, so it's kind of all over the network. But I think we got to get back to more frequency. And then we have a larger conversation about affordability, because overall the system's affordable, but we have to really think about the business model, like fare policy, and that's, you know, we have distance,
glad
we have
peak, and
all that kind of stuff.
Glad you're talking about the business model, because there's a lot standing in the way of fixing the issues we're talking about, not the least of which is Metro's budget shortfall. There's a projected $350 million gap, and Metro Board Finance Chair Matt Letourneau says difficult decisions are in the pipeline. Here he is at a board meeting earlier this month.
We will have a budget gap. You know, it's not as big as we were concerned that it would be, but it's still going to be sizable. And so we're going to have to decide, do we go entirely into reducing service and potentially impacting workforce as a way to save money, or do we look at our fare?
So what is your thinking about what the finance chair said? Are fare hikes or service interruptions already baked in?
Yeah, I won't, you know, obviously the board member had his comment. I have to get in, work with the team. We had a little bit of work on that this week, but next week we're going to be diving in really deep on some budget work, really to see how big of our delta. And, you know, over the upcoming weeks and a few months, we got a lot of work to do on that to see how much we are truly maybe off. I think we're going to figure out how to get towards an FY23 budget solution, working in a variety of ways. I am actually more concerned probably with the long-term funding plan for Metro. You know, we need predictable, reliable funding, both on the capital and the operating side. And to do that, we need the community to come together and say, what do we all agree Metro needs to be? So if we want a premier great transit system that's, to Tom's point, frequent, safe, reliable, covering all the hours that we need across the region, then we can go and figure out how we're going to pay for that. And so every time someone asks me, hey, what are we doing to fix this? I think we first all have to agree, what do we want Metro to be coming out in kind of the post-COVID world?
Well, some people would say, and this is my hardcore question here, are saying, is that Metro is doomed. It was built as a strict commuter rail into and out of the District of Columbia, and it wasn't designed to serve the whole metro area, which has to pay for it. You've got a $2 billion plus budget, operating budget. You've got 14,000 employees plus thousands more contractors. 68% of your budget is personnel. You also have, and it's often not mentioned, an unfunded pension liability. Last time I checked, it was over four, heading towards $5 billion. And your investments, like everyone else in the stock market now, the investments have taken a hit because of the hits to the stock market over the last year. So it seems to me you have no way to get out of a budget spiral unless you can do the one thing Metro General Managers have not been able to do, and that's to get buy-in from the federal government, either to assume the pension liability or to provide operating funds and not just capital funds for all the federal workers that use your system. Where's the hope for your budget?
Well, Tom, I don't think it's doomed. If I thought it was doomed, I wouldn't be sitting in this chair talking to you two.
You wouldn't have taken the job.
Yeah, and on day five, I hope my optimism is still that it's not doomed, obviously, and hopefully you and the community will, you know, give us a chance here on that.
That's a pretty stark photo, picture, I think.
Yeah,
I just painted.
But you know, there's a lot on that. It's an onion, right? So on the pension stuff, I would argue that most government authorities have a pension program. There's, you know, unfunded and funded aspects of that. I put that to the side because I don't think that is as dire as, you know, the other part. I don't think that the federal government is the only silver bullet here. I mean, clearly the federal government is a major partner. I think most of us around the country would love to see the federal government help with operating around transit that you would see more in other countries. But that's not a WMATA-specific thing. I'm sure New York and San Francisco and Boston and Philly and all these other big systems would think that. With that said, though, you mentioned the commuter model. Yes, that's true. But we're also an incredible region where we have tens of millions of visitors every year. We have big events. We have an active nightlife. We are a robust economy. And so we have to get, you know, we have to do a lot of things at the same time. We have to be a commuter solution for congestion relief. We have to be an environmental player for helping with climate change and what we care about. We have to be a major tool to help with regional inequities, to help people get access to opportunity. And we have to help with the economy. So, you know, we might have to move a lot more people at night than we used to do. And maybe on Friday a.m. rush hour is a little different than we used to do. So that's this whole transformation of what we are as a region and how Metro is the lifeblood that really creates the opportunity for people to get around.
Richard Howell tweets, please ask Clark if those responsible for the safety lapses and consequent service cutbacks will be held to account. Riders have to see this happen, says Richard.
Yeah, I can't speak to before I got here, obviously, right? My job is to dig in. I appreciate Richard's comment. My job is not to live in the past. My job is to move the future forward. And all I can say, and I think, you know, I said this to the board during the interview process, my job is to be accountable. And I have to deliver the results for the community, and therefore my team will be accountable to me through that process. So I, you know, that has to be fact-driven, evidence-based, and we are going to create a team process that full of trust. And we're going to work together, and we are going to deliver what the community needs.
Some people have suggested that if you can get the jurisdictions, Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., and the federal government to participate in the operating costs of Metro, that maybe you should consider making the system free.
Yeah, I've heard that too. So there's this big conversation around, and I think we got to be careful what free means, because there's nothing in life that's free. The fire department's not free.
Only that you would not have fare gates.
Exactly. So fare free is different than
fare
free.
Free.
And I think that's really is an important part. I think most people are starting to turn a little bit and realize that there is some value in fare from a point of view of kind of system rules, but also ownership. You feel an ownership and, you know, participation. With that said, that is a policy decision and a community-based decision. One way or the other, we need the money to run the system. And maybe that is part of a trade-off, which is if we had some dedicated funding that is Metro's funding and therefore not as reliant on the jurisdictional partners, then maybe the people in certain, whether it's bus or rail or different parts of day or whatever, maybe it's discounted or fare-free or whatever. Okay. We need to, I think, put everything on the table, Tom, and have a real deep discussion about how fare policy and funding all come together.
Can I have one quick question on fares?
Okay.
I was at Lafont on Monday. A family was trying to make sense of the fare machines. Those machines you cannot figure out how to use them if you don't know what they are.
Yeah, no.
Can you simplify those?
Listen, you and I hope you help them with your Rosetta Stone.
Make them responsive to voice commands.
Yeah,
or just simple. I want a fare card, and that's all I want to do. I don't want to read the text of the Bible before I do.
That's right. And so we have, I think, probably the most complicated fair table in business.
Right.
So, but I do encourage people to, you know, our new mobile aspect is really good. You can just touch your phone and move forward. But I think this is this larger conversation about coming to grips with fairs and what they are. They need to be simple, convenient, and fair.
I'd like to move on to safety because it's an issue that a lot of riders expressed concern about. Earlier this week, a young woman told a heart-wrenching story on TikTok. It's difficult to hear, but she was sexually harassed at the Foggy Bottom station. Here's just a bit of what she had to say.
Metro, this is a systemic problem, and so many women don't feel safe taking the train to work, and I hope that some change can come from this.
She also says in her video that what made this incident all the more scary was that she still had to wait 10 minutes for her train, another connection to service frequency. Have you spoken? Have you reached out to her directly? Can you tell us anything about the investigation into this incident?
Yeah, I would. I think it's really, you know, I don't want to get into specific investigations or cases, but I will say I did put out a social media, mentioned how I really, on a personal level, on behalf of Metro, apologize. I find the behavior that she describes despicable. I think we should all find that as society despicable and unacceptable. You know, COVID has, not just on transit, I think, if we're going to be fair, society-wise now, we've lost a little bit about our societal norms and structure and rules. And, you know, we're part of the city and part of the region. So something that doesn't happen on Metro doesn't happen somewhere else. To that end, I, you know, your linkage to frequency is true. Our service, if we are running good, safe, reliable service, the entire system works better. It's like a park. An empty park generally leads to, you know, maybe behavior in a park that's not as good for a community. People maybe don't want to use it. A busy park is what people want because we want people in there, more eyes, more ears, everyone kind of in it together. So your link to frequency is important. We also have to really think through some where our deployment of uniform personnel are, both civilian and police. I want the community to know I'm on the system. I mentioned my wife's on the system. I want to ensure that people feel safe being on our system. And again, what the behavior the woman described is completely unacceptable. And I would encourage all of us as a society, if we see that kind of behavior, to report it, but also help each other during that type of behavior. And that's not just in Metro, that's anywhere.
The answer to safety issues can sometimes go in the direction of law enforcement, but even that comes with its own pitfalls. A writer recently posted a video of an officer carrying a long gun on a Metro platform. Metro later identified the officer as part of a special patrol team, but many were still uneasy because they found it hard to identify him as part of law enforcement. We actually got an email from Elvia who said, I found the image of a security officer on the platform carrying an assault rifle very disturbing. I want to be secure, but that looks like a shootout waiting to happen. How do you intend to balance the competing concerns of safety and the law enforcement presence?
Yeah, certainly a complex topic. I think, again, not just Metro specific. In our society right now, we need to be community-centric policing. And I've talked to the police chief about that. He agrees. You know, that case, again, I there's a little bit more to dig in on that, but you know, if we're going to have officers in our stations, they need to be well identified because, if anything, that officer is there to actually show how we're trying to keep the system safe for people. You know, unfortunately, in America right now, there is a fair amount of gun violence, lots of active shooter scenarios. So I appreciate the comment that it was unnerving for people. The police were looking at it from a point of view of actually assurance. But the takeaway to me is we got to be really good at identification and really use community-centric engagement of our customers when we have police out.
They need to be well-trained so they don't come on as if they're occupying the Metro system rather than protecting your customers.
For sure.
But let me ask quickly, is your police force large enough?
Well, that is a big question. So, you know, I'm starting to look through the vacancies and getting through a lot of details. We clearly have a fair amount of vacancies across Metro. So, encourage
every
anyone
police
out there,
department is
anyone
having
out
trouble.
There looking for a job, please go to
right. Police departments across the board
across
are looking for people.
Yeah, so we are definitely short of officers. But you know, there might be other ways to think through this on public safety, kind of, you know, platform attendance. public safety ambassadors to, that are maybe more civilian-based to complement our police. I think that's part of this holistic... I really want to be customer-centric in everything we do, and so we need to put it all on the table right now.
Very quickly, nothing we've asked you is a surprise. Have you been surprised by anything in your brief time here?
You only have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, you know, I really feel fortunate to have this opportunity. I'm committed to doing what is needed to get Metro back to being the pride of this region. I appreciate how warm and welcoming people have been. Not big surprises, and I think the future ahead could be brighter than maybe most people think it is right now.
That's because we haven't turned up the heat yet. Randy Clark is the new Umata General Manager. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks, Kojo.
Up next, Wes Moore, the projected winner of the Democratic primary for Maryland governor. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour. Joining us now is Wes Moore, the projected winner of the Democratic primary for Maryland governor. He's a best-selling author and former nonprofit CEO. Wes Moore, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
Before we get to the Maryland governorship, Tom Sherwood, let's talk Virginia governorship, because it would appear that after about 6 months in office, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, according to a poll conducted by Virginia Commonwealth University, seems to be doing pretty well. 49% of Virginians approve of the way he's governing the state, 38% disapprove.
Well, if you compare it to President Joe Biden's rank, that's pretty good. I think that Joe Biden's in the low to mid-30s. But yes, this is good news for the new governor, the one-term governor. He can't succeed himself. He's gotten, of course, a lot of Democratic criticism for his travels around the country, for his conservative positions on teaching in public schools, and for back when he was running for governor, just not recommending masks. It's recommending masks, but not mandating masks. But he's done well. He's got a Democratic legislature there in the Senate that can stop lots of things he's tried to do. But I think bottom line overall, for him to have a 49% approval rating, 38% disapproval, is pretty good for his first 7-8 months.
And what's going on with the vote counting in Maryland in general, and Montgomery County in particular, where there are still 8 council seats that have yet to be decided? But what I want to talk about briefly is that the Montgomery County executive race between the incumbent Mark Elrich and David Blair is apparently still too close to call.
Yeah, there are still plenty of votes, depending on who you talk to, as many as anywhere from 17,000 to 25,000 or more votes to go. But, you know, the last update was that David Blair, who lost by 77 votes 4 years ago, currently holds a margin of 145 votes over incumbent Mark Elrich. But it is simply too close to call. I want to point out again that the only reason this is taking so long is because Governor Hogan refused to sign legislation to allow the Board of Elections around the state to count the mail-in ballots early to get them in a process to be counted for Election Day. It's his fault that we're waiting.
Nevertheless, Wes Moore is the projected winner of the Democratic primary for Maryland governor. He joins us now. Wes Moore, congratulations on winning the primary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be on both of you. Thanks again.
I knew your father when he was a radio reporter here at WMAL Radio, and you decided not to follow him in that profession, and well, look where it's gotten you, but I digress. We should also mention that we invited the Republican nominee Dan Cox on the show as well. We haven't heard back from him as yet. But it was a crowded field with a number of heavy hitters on the ballot in the primary. The Baltimore Sun editorial board called you an outsider, insider candidate who ran the smartest campaign in the race. How did you win?
Yeah, well, first, it's great to be with you. And I really appreciate you starting off talking about my dad. He loved his work. He loved his family. He loved the ability to use his voice to you know, both educate and impact society. And
he loved that Vespa scooter that he rode too. But go ahead.
But you know, but I take a real sense of pride for the fact that, you know, not only do I have you know, his name, but that, you know, I still very much feel that he guides me. And I think that, you know, it's actually really in many ways embodies the type of campaign that we just tried to run. I think that the reason that we won is because we assembled an unparalleled coalition. I think we won because we stayed positive and we spoke directly to the issues that we're facing families in Maryland right now. And we continue to hear from people that issues like public safety and crime, issues of education and the economy, these were the issues that were first and foremost on people's mind. And I think we just continue to offer a future-facing vision for how our state can actually tackle these challenges, but also really just hold on to the opportunities that are standing in front of us.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Welcome, Mr. Moore. I appreciate it. It would be extraordinary if the final results were to come in and change the outcome. So let me say congratulations on your primary win. It was very impressive with the number of endorsements you had and your strength across the state. Now, my question. You are new to election politics. I think you like to say you're not a politician, but of course, because you're running for office, you are. We'll see whether you're a good one or a bad one as the time plays out. But let me ask you, are you satisfied that your background, your life story has been fully vetted as you introduce yourself to all the voters for November in Maryland, not just the Democrats? You know the Republican campaign and its supporters will be vetting you all over again. Are you comfortable that those questions that were raised about where you were born and all of that have been satisfied for the voters?
I am, Tom, and I know that our campaign was the most vetted campaign in this entire field. I think we were probably vetted more than any other, combined. And the thing that I think that people continue to see as we've gone through the vetting is when you think about my life, I have nothing to exaggerate. I watched my father die in front of me when I was almost 4 years old because he didn't get the health care that he needed. I watched how my mother did not get her first job that gave her benefits after my dad died until I was 14 years old. And this is a woman who has a master's degree. And so I think when people looked at not just my background, but also my professional background, the fact that I volunteered to join the military, I served honorably and was a decorated combat veteran in Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division, and served and led paratroopers, earned a combat action badge. I think that my background, my history has been vetted. And I know that the thing that people continue to focus on was our vision for a brighter and a bolder future for the state of Maryland.
Let me get to that because I think that's important. You are a very good aspirational, inspirational speaker, which is a good quality for a politician. I have listened to both your celebrity interviews with Oprah Winfrey and David Rubenstein, as well as countless Zoom forums that I know that you were well, I'm sure you were tired of some of them too, but you wouldn't say that. But beyond the aspirational promise that you're going to bring everyone together, to leave no child behind, to not be afraid to fail, would you name one or two real policy proposals that you intend to bring before the legislature in January?
Yeah, I'm proud of the fact that I think our campaign was full of solid, hardcore policy recommendations. I think if anything, people learned when they throughout this campaign that I'm a policy wonk by nature. And so when we're talking about things like we are going to make Maryland the first state in this country to have a service year option for every single high school graduate. And we're going to do it because, A, I believe that it's going to help address the college affordability crisis.
Is that the first thing? Is that one? I know you have a very long list and on virtually every subject matter that a governor will deal with. But I'm just thinking, are you already intending to have something you will propose in January when the legislature meets?
These are issues that we plan on proposing in January that we are planning on getting done. That we know that we are going to propose, how can we have a more robust transportation infrastructure and one that is going to both connect the state with each other, but also connect the state in terms of on a regional basis, that we know that we have concrete proposals on things we're going to get done when it comes to addressing public safety. And that includes things like fixing the broken parole and probation system and being able to make sure that we're using state resources to be able to support local jurisdictions in this fight again, in this fight on public safety, that we know we have policies around housing that we're going to put in place to make sure that we believe in the concept that housing is a fundamental human right. And these are platforms and policies that we're going to focus on.
Excuse me for interrupting. Yes, those are the broad goals of all the subject matters that are looming ahead of you as the next governor. But just to take one, for example, you mentioned housing as a right. What does that mean? If you can be we don't have a lot of time, but it's a little more specific. What does that mean when you say housing is a right? What does it mean to the family down the street or the single individual up the street?
And what kind of specific legislation would you propose on the issue of housing?
Yeah, so for example, you know, we would make sure that we're going to fully invest in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which has been depleted during this time period, and ensuring that people do have the opportunity to have access to that capital and access to the Housing Trust Fund. It means being able to take a look at the inventory that's currently available and making sure we're preserving the available inventory that's there, because much of the inventory that we have when it comes to affordable housing, it's inhabitable. And we've allowed it to get that way. There are things that we can do and things that we can invest in that can actually bring up a greater level of inventory that people can have, in addition to being able to protect renters that are in place right now. It's the reason that I believe in things like being able to have a right to counsel for people who are facing eviction court, because oftentimes it is landlords that will have a right to counsel, but it's tenants who do not.
Okay, just to be clear, though, when you say people have a right to housing, that means that the state's going to will provide housing for every person that is in need of housing. Is that what you mean by the right? Or are you just going to make it better and easier to help people who need housing? A right seems you get it.
Yeah, no, but I think that when we're talking about what we mean by a right to housing, it means that we are drastically going to invest in additional affordable housing, additional affordable housing inventories, that when you look at our state, there's no reason. When you look at the basic geography of the state and when you look at our housing inventory, there is no reason that we have people who find themselves housing insecure, particularly when you consider the fact that the number one driver of poverty that we have in our state is housing insecurity. That's something that the state can take a unique measure of leadership on, and something that we plan on working in partnership to be able to make happen.
I will be surprised if you can get the General Assembly to say that every citizen of the Maryland has a right to housing. It's a great goal, but I'd be surprised if that were to put into law.
Well, I want to move to another issue. Specifically, we got an email from Nick. Please ask Wesmore about his juvenile justice policy. What is your juvenile justice policy?
Yeah, well, I think, and thank you for that question, Nick. I mean, there's a few different things that we have to do when it comes to juvenile justice. You know, one is we have to understand that when you look at the adult prison population, oftentimes you're talking about a juvenile population that has now gotten older. So the propensity of having that pipeline to people involved in the juvenile system that end up in the adult system is significant. And so the way we can address the adult population is being able to better invest in the juvenile population. And that is something that specifically falls under the jurisdiction of the governor. The rise and the challenge that we're seeing amongst juvenile crime, while people will oftentimes look at local jurisdictions to be able to solve the challenge, that cannot be solved without leadership from the state, because the Department of Juvenile Services and Juvenile Justice actually falls as a state jurisdiction. And so that includes various mechanisms, such as focusing on rehabilitation and focusing on reentry, having proper educational supports for students that are involved inside of the juvenile justice system, but then also being able to think clearly about how are we thinking about the reasons that we have this significant portion of pipeline of children involved in the juvenile justice system in the first place. You know, it's a very personal issue for me, where, you know, I felt handcuffs on my wrist when I was 11 years old. And it's because I, you know, came up in areas that were over-policed, and oftentimes that was the only way that things were dealt with. And so when we think about what that means, and we know that every single interaction with law enforcement, everyone, even if one that does not result in conviction, will have a significant impact on long-term educational and long-term economic prospects.
This brings me to this.
What does the phrase defund the police mean to you?
I mean, I think defund the police is a phrase. It's not a platform. And it's not a policy. I think that we need to ensure that we have policing in our state that moves with appropriate intensity and absolute integrity, right? That we can have a policing force that serves a community but also has high measures of accountability. It's one of the reasons that I believe what the legislature passed last year around the policing reform was a smart bill and an important first step on the things that we need to be able to do to get done. But we also have to be very clear that we're not going to arrest nor militarize our way out of the challenge that we're having within our communities, particularly when it comes to violent crime.
Gotcha.
Okay.
I want to get back to politics for a second, because ahead of the primary, the Democratic Governors Association poured around $1 million into ads featuring the Trump-backed Republican contender Dan Cox, who has apparently won. The assumption is that a far-right candidate will be easy to defeat in blue Maryland. What was your view of that strategy?
Yeah, I think that we are doing a major disservice if we're underestimating the impact that Dan Cox is going to have. Dan Cox is the Republican nominee, and he needs to be taken very seriously. And our campaign is taking him very seriously. And you know, but when I think about what it meant and what the DGA's ad, I also don't believe that a single ad was the reason that Dan Cox won the nomination. And I also don't believe that that the DGA putting together and exposing Dan Cox for what he is was the reason that he won. The reality is that Dan Cox wouldn't deny a single word in the ad that the DGA put out. Dan Cox is an insurrectionist. Dan Cox did go down on January 6th and pay for people to go down. Dan Cox is someone who believes in the full banning of abortion in all cases. So all right. There's nothing that was said in that ad that was incorrect.
More politics.
More
politics. Just one more before Tom gets
in. I've got two questions about Dan.
About Dan
about
Cox.
Him.
Okay.
All right. Will you right now, if you haven't already, commit to at least one statewide debate, an accessible statewide debate with your Republican opponent, Dan Cox?
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Okay, so yes.
To debate our ideas. With Dan Cox. So, and I'm very excited about the chance to be able to put my vision and values and our vision for the future of the state of Maryland against Dan Cox.
Okay, good. In one of your interviews with Oprah Winfrey, she asked you if you would run for mayor of Baltimore, and you laughed and basically said no. But you also said that you liked the work you were doing because in politics, campaigns are too often just two things: be afraid and who to blame, meaning that in order to win an election, voters have to be made afraid of something and then blame the other side so they'll vote for you. Now, you have said you're a different kind of politician, but it sounds to me like that you're going to run a classic campaign of saying that Dan Cox is a danger to Maryland.
Yeah, but I do believe that. I do believe that Dan Cox is a danger to
But what about the be afraid and who to blame? And you criticized that policy when you were talking to Ms. Winfrey.
Yes. No, so in fact, let me finish. So because I do believe that Dan Cox is a fundamental danger. But the thing that I'm also presenting to the people of the state of Maryland is I believe that our support and the reason that we're going to win in the general election is not because we're telling people to be afraid of something. It's because we're asking people to be hopeful for something. It's that I believe that the future for the state of Maryland is bright. I believe that this is going to be Maryland's decade. I believe that we can be a state that can be more competitive while also being more equitable. I believe we are a state that can close the racial wealth gap in our time. I believe we are a state that is going to deal with the issue of climate change with a measure of seriousness that is required in this moment. I believe we are a state that can work in partnership with the private sector, with the legislative branch, with the executive branch, with nonprofit organizations, and with the people to be able to tackle these generational challenges with a new sense of urgency.
Back to politics.
Right, absolutely. But I also believe that the reason that we're going to win in November is not because people are afraid of something. We're going to win in November because people are hopeful for something.
We got an email from Will in Adelphi who says Wes Moore has won the Democratic primary with only about 35% of the vote, far from a majority. We have no way of knowing if he even has nominal approval of a majority. If he wins the general election, will Wes Moore push to institute ranked choice voting in Maryland? What is your view of ranked choice voting?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm proud of the fact that we received more votes than anybody running for governor on either side. And I believe that the coalition that we built is going to be a strong one going into the general. You know, I think that ranked choice voting is an interesting concept, and it is worth exploring. I also know that for this election and for this race, ranked choice voting is not something that is on the table for the state of Maryland.
It's not something you would propose for the legislature on your agenda. Let me ask a hardcore issue for you. There are aspirational and there are long-term changes you want to make to the government of Maryland. But one of the biggest ones in this metropolitan Washington region, as you well know, is what the hell are you going to do about I-495, I-270, and the American Legion Bridge? I know you've been briefed at least and looked at this significantly. What kind of specific things are going to guide you as you go forward with that? This is Hogan's plan. It's been held up. You, whoever is the next governor, will have to deal with it. What do you want? Do you want to see reversible lanes on 270 or portions of I-495? Do you want to see rapid bus lanes? Do you personally have an idea of what you want to do, knowing that you'll negotiate and get all the stakeholders together and all that stuff? But what do you want to see?
Absolutely. And I do have tremendous concern about the current project as it is proposed.
What is the concern? What is kind of specifically?
Yeah, and particularly as it relates to, you know, how our taxpayer dollars are being used. And so I know that we have to address the measure of congestion, and that is something that is going to be a high priority.
Yeah, but I understand it's high priority, but you're not being, I'm asking you, do you support, some people have suggested there should be rapid bus lanes on 270. Would you support that? Would you support reversible rush hour lanes?
Yeah, so the answer is yes. I would like to see things as transit. I'd like to see reversible lanes. I'd like to see all these things. And part of the challenge that I have with the proposal is so many of these assets that were actually included in this type of plan prior have been removed. And so I think that there needs to be a way for us to talk about, you know, how we can actually use current footprints, how we are talking about things like mass transit and reversible lanes. But there's three lenses that I'm going to look at all transportation initiatives that we're pushing together. One is equity, and that includes who is building it and who can benefit from it. The second one is the second piece is the environment, and what becomes the environmental impact of all the decisions that are being made about how we're increasing and enhancing transportation assets. The third piece is going to be conversations with community stakeholders and the people and local elected officials. The challenge that I have with the current plan that's pulled together, the current plan that's proposed by Governor Hogan, is on all three of those lenses, those three factors were not fully considered. And so that's my challenge with it. And I would like to see for us to include things like mass transit and reversible lanes in a new type of proposal.
Many Maryland residents are worried about inflation and the economy. What is your plan to help people feeling the pinch from the rising cost of everything from gas to groceries? And we only have about a minute and a half left.
Yeah, well, I mean, the challenge that people are feeling, it is real. Things are more expensive. And I think that there's a couple things we have to do that we can do on the state side to impact the supply side challenge that we have of inflationary pressure. That includes getting people back to work. And so that's why one of the proposals that you will see come January is we've got to focus on fixing a broken childcare system. Since the start of COVID, we have over 800 childcare centers that have closed. That has had a disproportionate impact on workers, particularly female workers and working mothers who have not been able to get back to work. And many of the childcare providers are female entrepreneurs, and they've never been treated as such.
So does that mean in January, Mr. Moore, that you'll have a proposal to deal with that in terms of funding? State, the District of Columbia, for example, has added money to childcare workers to keep those spaces open. They're critically needed. We understand how critical they are, but would you propose something in January, money that will go to these child care facilities?
Less than a minute left.
Absolutely. And we've stated that, that will be included in addition to things like job retraining and job reskilling programs. Right now in the state of Maryland, we have two jobs available for every person that's filing for unemployment. We have a skill set disconnect that we as a state need to take a measurement of leadership on. The third piece we have to do to address the inflationary pressure and make things more affordable is we've got to increase the minimum wage. Right now, it's set to increase to $15 by 2025. That is too late. It needs to happen in the first year of our administration, and we will make sure it does.
Okay, that's a major proposal. Good, thank you.
Wes Moore is the projected winner of the Democratic primary for Maryland governor. He's a best-selling author and former nonprofit CEO. Wes Moore, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you both.
And I'm afraid that's all.
Do we have time to mention Mega Millions is $1 billion tonight? $1 billion?
No, we have another important announcement. It's somebody's birthday tomorrow, and that happens to be you. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Be safe. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Nandi was produced today by Ryan Bank. Our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Our engineer is Kellen Quigley, and our broadcast engineer is Kennedy Wright. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Jonathan Blakely oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.